It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My next guest, Maya Angelou, is a writer, performer, teacher, and director whose autobiographies include I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. She's also written 2 cookbooks, 5 poetry collections, and 3 books of essays, including Letter to My Daughter. If America didn't know about Maya Angelou before President Clinton took office, it certainly did after her reading of her poem On the Pulse of Mourning at his inauguration. Her latest book, Mom and Me and Mom, is out just in time for Mother's Day, and she joins us by phone. Maya Angelou, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much, Mr. Guggenheimer.
I read Mom and Me and Mom in one sitting, and it is much more of a page-turner than I ever could have expected. And in it, you talk about your mother, Vivian Baxter, an amazing woman and an even more amazing character. How would you describe her?
Well, I would use those words and then add to them. She was hilarious. She was really, she could have been a stand-up comedian. She liked to make people laugh. She had a way with words, so that and she didn't mind cursing. And not being a curser myself at first, it shocked me so, because I had lived with my grandmother, my father's mother, from the time I was 3 until I was 13, and that in a little village in the South. And my grandmother was very, not only very private and very proper, she was very religious. And so not only did we not curse, we didn't speak loudly in the house. I went to my mother in San Francisco, and she had records on the record player, and she danced in the middle of the dining room floor and in the kitchen, and she cursed whenever she liked. And sometimes I think she cursed just to shock people. And she achieved it with me, because she shocked me so that I thought she was a foreign being. And at first, I really didn't want to call her mother. And she said, you'll have to address me as something. So she asked, why didn't I want to call her mother? I said, she was nothing like a mother. I thought mothers were like my grandmother, where everybody spoke softly, and you didn't dare question what they said to be the rules. Vivian Baxter said, if you don't like what I'm saying, ask me why I say it, and then ask me to repeat it and tell me why you don't like it. And finally, I told her I'd rather call her Lady, because she was so pretty, and she was just, she reminded me of what a lady should be like. She said, all right, I'll introduce myself to everyone as Lady.
At first, you didn't smile around your mother. Your mother had to ask you to smile.
Yes.
What did you learn from that day?
Well, I learned, she said, if you have one smile in you, give it to me. Give it here in the house with people, to people who care about you, who care to put food on the table and clothes on your back and shoes on your feet. Don't be doer and sour here in the house, and go out and to complete strangers, widen your lips and give a big smile. She said, that's not fair. But that made sense to me. And once when I did smile, she made me laugh. She said, oh, my baby has the prettiest smile. Oh, my goodness. And she called up people and said, my baby just smiled at me. And I learned, well, you know, you can be generous. And a generous action can be rewarding, not just to the person who received the action, but to the person who gives the generosity.
Can you tell us about the time you stole your mother's whiskey and what that particular story illustrates?
Yes. My mother had ladies who lived in the house, roomers, and some of them worked in her gambling joints, and some of them did other things, which I wasn't supposed to know about. My mother knew I wouldn't lie. I was, well, the truth was I was too proud to lie. It wasn't that I was so good. I just didn't want to get caught and be made to humble myself and beg pardon for lying. So she had a money closet in which she kept lots and lots of cash and for the gambling house and also liquor. So I was sitting at the kitchen table with her and some of the women, and some of the women were only 3 or 4 or 5 years older than I. And she said, you know, I'm missing some liquor. And Papa Ford, who worked for her, was a houseman. She said, only Papa Ford and Maya have keys to the liquor closet. So everybody looked at her, and she asked me, have you been drinking the liquor? I said, no, I have not. So she said, well, then that's the end of it. If you haven't been drinking it, I know if you had been, you'd have told me. So I said nothing. When I got ready to go, I got up to leave. And she said, okay, baby, so you don't know anything about the liquor. I said, I didn't say that. I said, I didn't drink it. She asked me, well, do you know something about it? I said, yes, I've been taking it. She said, this was during World War II, when the liquor was not only hard to get and ration, but very expensive. And she said, you've been taking my liquor? Where? How? I said, I pour it into a mason jar, and I take it to the New Fillmore Theater on Sunday, the movie house, and give it to the kids. She asked, why? I said, because I want them to like me. She almost came across that table. Oh, no. I said, after all, it only costs $1.75 a shot, and there are only so many shots in a bottle. And she almost leapt over the table. Fortunately, she didn't reach me. She said that was stupid and just shouted at me, and I wasn't used to that. So I went upstairs to my room, and when my brother came, I told him what had happened and how badly she'd spoken to me. And he said, well, that was stupid. My brother, who was my heart, he talked to me worse than my mother. He said, do you realize that she could not only lose money, she can go to jail? I hadn't thought of that, of course. I just took the liquor. But she didn't make any more mention of it, except when my stepfather was there, she told him that I had been taking the liquor. And they just all clucked, like, you know, how stupid. But they didn't. She didn't chastise me anymore. I knew, of course, that was a stupid thing to do because Bailey had told me, my brother, and never did it again.
Your mother could be very tough, but yes. she was also had this very understanding side. You became pregnant with your son Guy when you were in high school, and this was during the 40s, at a time when such a thing would bring or could bring shame to a family. But your mother was amazingly understanding and supportive in a way that a lot of parents might not have been.
It's true. My mother asked me, my stepfather had asked me the night before how far pregnant was I. And I told him I would be having the baby in about 3 weeks. So my mother was up in Alaska with one of their joints, one of their gambling joints. And he called her, and she flew down that morning. And she walked in the house. She said, you're more than any 3 weeks pregnant. I said, I know. I'm going to have the baby in about 3 weeks. She asked me, do you know who the father is? I said, of course. I only had sex with him once. She said, and do you love him? I said, no. She asked, does he love you? I said, no. She said, then we're not going to ruin 3 lives. That's all. We're going to have a fine baby. That's all there is to it. And she never once made me feel I had brought shame on the family. Never once. She just was that kind of woman. And she loved my son. And he adored her.
your mother saved your life. Literally saved you when an abusive boyfriend beat you within an inch of your life. Describe how she came to your rescue.
Well, the man had taken me back to his room in a rooming house, and I had passed out, and when I tried to sit up, I couldn't. Of course, I found that later on that my ribs, I had broken ribs, but I couldn't breathe enough to holler. And the man at one point said, he sat beside the bed, he took a razor blade, a single-edged razor blade, and put it on his neck. He said, "I should kill myself because I've treated you so badly." And then he said, "No, I'll kill you because then I won't leave you to have somebody else have you, let somebody else have you." And then, it was just horrible, and I couldn't breathe. He asked me, "Do you like pineapple juice? I'll go get some pineapple juice. I'll get some orange juice. Don't worry, when I come back, I'm going to nurse you back to health." And he left. I couldn't get out of the bed. I couldn't sit up. And all of a sudden, I heard noises, wham-a-lam-a-lam, down the hall, shouting. And my mother, I heard my mother's voice. And she said, "Break the SOB down." And a door came crashing in. Two huge men who were people that hung around her pool hall. Two huge men broke the door down. My mother stepped in and saw me and passed out. She said it was the first and only time in her life she'd fainted. But I had, my teeth had gone through my lips, and I just looked a mess. But she she got me and took me to the hospital and made sure whatever could be done would be done. And she asked me to kill a man. I said, "I can't." She said, "I don't know why not. I'd shoot him like a dog in the street." But I couldn't do it. It just was not my nature. And she almost teased me about it. She and my brother, and they all said, "Well, you know, Maya is tenderhearted."
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is writer, performer, teacher, director Maya Angelou. Her latest book is Mom and Me and Mom. It's about her life with her mother, Vivian Baxter. Ms. Angelou, would you have become the person you are without your mother, without Vivian Baxter?
No. No, no. There's so many things I did because she said, "If you want to do it, go do it. You want a job, go get it." And I went down to get a good job on the streetcars because I'd seen women on the streetcars. I hadn't noticed that the women were all white. We're just women. And I liked the way their uniforms fit them, and they had caps with bibs on them, and they had the little money changers and, on the belt, and they just looked smart. So I said I wanted a job on the streetcars. My mother said, "Go get it." When I went down to get to apply, the people at the desk wouldn't even give me an application. And I went back to my mother, really drained. She asked me, "Do you know why they wouldn't?" I said, "Yes." She asked me why. I said, "Because I'm a Negro." She said, "That's right. But do you want the job?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Go get it. Take a good book down with you. You be there in the office as soon as the secretaries get there. You sit there, and you leave for lunch after they leave, but be back before they get back, and you sit there and read."
You brought Dostoevsky, did you?
I'm sorry?
You brought Dostoevsky with you, right?
I did. Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, all of them. But the truth is, after the second day, I wanted to come home. I just didn't dare let my mother know I wasn't as strong as she thought I was. So I sat there for 2 weeks every day. And the girls who worked in the office, some of them I had helped with their schoolwork out of George Washington High School. But they came by, they made all sorts of remarks, racist remarks, and pretended their lips were big and pushed them out at me. And, oh, it was terrible. But I sat there. And finally, a man came out of an office and said, come in here. And he asked me, why do you want a job with the it was, I think, Market Street Railway. And I said, because I like people and I like the uniforms. It's very silly. He asked me what experience I had. I told him the biggest lie in life. I told him I had been the chaufferette for Mrs. Annie Henderson in Stamps, Arkansas. And that was my grandmother, who had hardly ever been in a car, let alone had somebody drive her around in it. But I got the job.
You were, in fact, the first African-American woman to be a streetcar conductorette in San Francisco. And
that's true.
You relied on your mother's support. There are numerous examples of this in the book, and there's a great one about when, you know, you're in your 40s and they're filming your screenplay, Georgia, in Sweden, and yeah. you called and you asked your mother to come over and be with you and lend moral support. Did you, in some ways later, want Vivian to be there to mother you, to perhaps compensate for? Go ahead.
That's what I asked her. I said, please come and mother me. I need some mothering. And I said, I'll send a check in the mail. As soon as you get it, come over. She said, when I get back, my check will be there waiting for me. But if anything is leaving for Stockholm tomorrow morning, I'll be there at some time tomorrow.
Examples like this, do they symbolize in some ways perhaps an effort on your part to compensate for the years you missed being with her as a child? Because you really came to realize that your mother was an amazing person.
Yes, but I didn't realize that for many years. I was 22 when it just hit me like like some physical slam. I was walking down the street with her, and she said, you know, baby, I think you're the greatest woman I've ever met. I was 22. She owned hotels and pool halls and had big diamond earrings on, and I wouldn't take a penny from anyone. And I didn't know what to say. She said, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, Mary McLeod Bethune, and my mother, she said, you're in that category. And she gave me a kiss and walked across the street to get into her car. And I continued down the street and got into the streetcar on Fillmore Street. And I sat there and thought, suppose she's right. Suppose I am going to be somebody. She's very intelligent, and she said she was too mean to lie. And so suppose she's telling the truth, then maybe I'd better stop doing some of the things I was doing. I stopped cursing, stopped smoking, and stopped drinking. I didn't drink much anyway, and I didn't stop smoking, but I did stop cursing. From that day to this, and that was 60 years ago.
Can you see this being made into a movie?
It could be made into a wonderful movie. It could be, yes.
Is there a screenplay in the works?
I haven't thought about it. I just put the end on this. I'd like to. I don't know if I want to write it or not, but I'd like to see somebody act that role, be that woman. She was one of the wonders of the world to me. She thought that I could do anything, and I should do it.
Who would you cast as Vivian Baxter?
Probably Will Smith's wife, Jada?
Jada, yes.
Yeah. There are a number of young, bright women who are not teenagers, but really in their 30s, who would make wonderful Vivian Baxter.
Well, hopefully Jada Pinkett's listening. And
Jada Pinkett, that's right. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Maya Angelou has been my guest. Her latest book is Mom and Me and Mom. Maya Angelou, it's been an honor to have you on Essential Pittsburgh. Thank you so much for joining us, and happy Mother's Day.
Thank you very much, and a happy day for you to be a son.
It always is.
Thank you. Love.